we lead the broadcasters.
Yeah, please.
Just because we play what the people want.
I don't like.
So them a call us
pirates.
Them a call us
illegal broadcasters.
PTI tries to stop us, but they can't.
Welcome to the Interracial John Podcast. I'm your host, Leslie Mack. I'm joined, as always, by my co-host.
Very white guy.
And you're very white indeed. What's going on?
Saturday, yo.
Saturday.
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 Saturday. Saturday.
You know, people are calling for a real shitty winter, and maybe I shouldn't open my mouth.
Stop. Stop talking right now. Stop talking right
effing now. What about the shore traffic?
Stop. Just stop. Don't say anything else.
All right, do your spiel. Come on, get to it. Let's do it.
Welcome to the Interracial John Podcast. You can find us on iTunes or Stitcher Radio. Just search Interracial John. That's J-A-W-N. Or our website, interracialjohn.com. Of course, we're on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Tumblr. Just search at Interracial John. Again, J-A-W-N. We love to get feedback. So if you are so inclined, please leave us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. And we read 5-star reviews on the air. And that's a nod to the Black Guy Who Tips podcast. That's a rule that they made up and we have adopted it here. And
have we checked for reviews? I don't know.
Oh, I get an email if we get one. Yeah. Actually, I should check Stitcher. I don't know if I have that set up right. I'll check it out.
All right. Well, I see you. You subscribed. I see you. You could do a review.
Yeah, you too.
I'm just saying.
And you too.
You took the time to subscribe. We appreciate it.
Yeah.
Fist bump to the love, but you could do a review too.
Just review it. Yeah.
All right, so okay. What, you want to get into the news?
Let's do it.
The news is coming on. The news is coming on.
So we've talked on the show before about the podcast Serial.
Yes, Adnan.
Adnan Syed. His case was covered in the podcast Serial by Sarah Koenig. And
the most popular podcast in the history
in
of
the history of podcasting. Yeah. Anyways, he was granted an appeal by Maryland Court yesterday.
So she... I don't say that was her purpose, but that was kind of the purpose of her show.
I think that was Adnan's purpose for agreeing to be the subject of the show. I don't necessarily know if that was Sarah's point. But anyways, he was convicted in 2000 on charges of robbery, false imprisonment, and first degree murder of his ex-girlfriend, Haman Lee, and was sentenced to life in prison plus 30 years, which I don't know. Why would you bother with the plus, but whatever. His application was accepted on claims that his attorney, Christina Gutierrez, who died in 2004, provided him with insufficient counsel during his trial. He actually had two trials. One was a mistrial, and then the second trial he was found guilty. And this is all stemming from testimony from one Asia McLean, who says that she can provide a significant alibi for him during the time that Hay was allegedly killed. Hmm. And so that's...
But that's going back 15 years ago.
Yeah, it's kind of ridiculous. Anyways, Sarah did update the Serial podcast website with a statement. No matter what the Court of Special Appeals rules, it's quite possible that the whole majigala, I think that's what that means, ends up in Maryland's highest court, the Court of Appeals, because if this current panel of judges grants Adnan relief, the state is likely to appeal to the highest court. And likewise, if it denies Adnan relief, Adnan's attorney will probably do the same. It's bound to grind on for a long while yet. Plus, you know, he killed that girl, so there's that.
And the other, I feel like in these situations, these cases that are like this, once it gets kind of like murky and mired in a bunch of, you know, back and forth or this or that, at some point, if you have been convicted, I feel like the weight of that is such that, like, you now need to find somebody else to convict. Like, it's hard to just, you know,
right?
I mean?
Because her family now, like, they had closure. They had somebody who said did it. You proved that he did it. He was convicted. I don't want to say that it allowed them to move on, because I'm sure they will always miss their daughter. And I actually don't really like talking about it, because I think it was very exploitative of the family in this instance. But I think that for the prosecutors, then that becomes, okay, well, if the court is saying it wasn't him, who did do it?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, it definitely gets pretty tricky. But, you know, I think he did it, so.
Well,
you know.
I'm thinking specifically, look at the Central Park, was it 5-7?
Yeah.
They got railroaded, right? Like,
right.
You know, false, what do you call it? Confessions and stuff, like,
yep.
They were just kids. But they spent, god dang, like 20 part of, you know what I mean? Like a really large part of their life behind bars. It took an awful lot to get them out. And their circumstances weren't nearly as murky. They were railroaded, right? Adnan's situation is kind of murky.
Like, they weren't anywhere near the person that the incident occurred. Correct. And Adnan is the only person with motive thus far and was the girl's ex-boyfriend. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Completely different.
Very different. Murky's probably being
Murky is being polite. Extremely generous.
A little polite.
Extremely. So I was on Twitter this morning.
Twitter.
And I saw a retweet of a tweet that had the hashtag racist Rosie. And I was like, what the heck is that, racist Rosie? I didn't know what it was. So I click on it. I start kind of going down the rabbit hole that you can get into on boy. Twitter. And turns out that there was a pretty huge to-do with Rosie O'Donnell, one Rosie O'Donnell, and a Native American, or actually might even be Native Canadian, sorry, Native First Nations person woman of color on Twitter had a beef. So this... there's a little bit of backstory in that there's been a lot of pushback against Eve Ensler and the Vagina Monologues. Specifically, there was an issue with it going to Canada. It does this big thing, you know, on V-Day, Valentine's Day, because it's vagina, whatever.
Right.
And in Canada on February 14th, it's a big Indigenous People's Day. And it's a lot of action that goes along with this. And so when they were coming to Canada with this, there was a conflict. Okay.
The events was Vagina Monologues touring in Canada conflict. Got it.
Correct. Not just touring, because they kind of make it into like a big, you know,
they get Canadian stars.
Stars, but they make it into like a social justice kind of day of action worldwide, I should say. And so there was bristling there. And so there's been issues about it, generally speaking, because it was a link to this 1 billion rising campaign against violence against women, and bringing that large of a entity into a space that has been reserved for Indigenous people in Canada, of course, you know, ruffled.
You're going to step on some toes.
It's going to be problematic.
Yeah.
And she refused to, you know, back down, basically. She had, conversations, and she had conversations specifically with the woman that...
Rosie got into it with. Okay. So this individual is, prominent First Nations, I would say activist woman.
Absolutely.
In Canada.
Yep.
Who has previously faced down the likes of Eve Ensler and the Vagina Monologues.
Correct.
All right. I've got the backstory.
Okay. So cut to Eve Ensler is going to be on The View.
Okay.
Which Rosie is on. And has been pretty vocal, I should say, in her support for Eve Ensler, and I think they're friends, maybe. I don't really know, but whatever. She was coming on The View. So Lauren Chief Elk, who is the individual that I was just talking about, she has a blog post that was an open letter to Eve Ensler in response to the conversation they had about this situation and why it was so important, and, you know, hoping that that Eve would take a different route. I'll post all of this on the show notes, of course. I just wanted to provide that backstory just so everything's kind of in the good, correct
context. I'm with you. Got it.
Okay, so.
I feel like this rabbit hole gets deeper.
It gets so deeper. Oh, my God. It's ridiculous. Okay, so Rosie tweeted, Eve Ensler is going to be on The View. And Lauren tweeted, Eve Ensler will be on The View today. Can at Rosie Perez Brooklyn and at Rosie, please ask detailed questions about why people are still mass boycotting OBR V-Day, which is this 1 billion rising and V-Day. Okay.
So she's trying to call attention to, it's understandable.
Okay. She wants to ask.
Yeah.
Rosie tweets her back. No, because you are one person. One. So Lauren says, since Ensler will be on The View and Rosie seems to think it's one person who has a problem with her, can everyone please send her your blog links, because other people have been writing about this situation, not just Lauren Chief Elk.
Okay. Again, very appropriate response, I think.
Yeah. So here's Rosie's response. At Chief Elk. Cyberbully you, chief, ... go make your contribution to the world's suffering. Let me know how it goes. Peace to your distorted view.
Wow. Wow. That's really aggressive, man.
Very aggressive.
Am I crazy? That's like super like...
It's really bad. Wow. I was like, wow, that's pretty bad. So I think, geez, oh my gosh, that's pretty, you know.
When did that happen? This is on Twitter?
Yeah, and this happened the 5th, so that would have been Wednesday.
Okay.
Okay, wow. 9:30 in the morning. So Lauren, of course, because just like you and I just read this tweet, is like, bitch, you tried it. Okay.
For real.
So Lauren Chief Elk, and her handle is at Chief Elk.
She caps, goes, caps, caps, caps.
Says, yes, I'm fully aware of what especially white people are doing when they call me Chief. Okay. Because Rosie put that in, just stuck that in the middle of her tweet. And Rosie responds, it's your freaking Twitter name. What the fuck? In caps.
Really? So I just want to make sure she first goes a little bit angry. Mm-hmm. Then... when questioned even a little bit further, got like really angry and defensive and deflexive and like, fuck you, what the fuck?
Yeah.
Pretty much, right?
Right.
Okay.
So another individual says, hey, you guys, can you please remind Rosie that calling a Native person chief the way she insists on doing is, you know, racist? Okay. Rosie responds to this person, hey, Aura, can you tell highly sensitive people looking for a fight not to have at chief in their screen name?
So now she's trying to make equivocations like, well, I only called her Chief because her handle is Chief Lauren or Chief. What is it?
It's at Chief Elk because that's Elk. Her okay. last name, just to be clear.
You know, and but again, Rosie didn't call her Chief at Chief Elk. It wasn't a tweet. She said Chief wrote the word Chief.
Wrote the word Chief. Exactly. And it was meant exactly the way it was delivered.
Yeah.
Like, and, you know, don't come out here clapping at people on social media and then try and pretend like you weren't doing so.
Listen, I'm not
one to break down Twitter fights. And no, I don't even think I want this to illustrate something when I'm done laying it out because it gets actually worse.
Well, I was just going to interject real quick. You know, you and I have had similar sort of discussions in that individuals of, I would say anyone who's a marginalized individual, you're pretty able quickly and readily to tell when someone's coming at you a certain way versus not a certain way.
Right.
And me as a white person, I've made the mistake often enough that like if somebody tells me, especially you, like, hey, listen, this was sideways and kind of right, I'm like, oh my God, of course. You know what I mean? Like, I don't question that. I don't like double down and go, what the fuck your screen name is? You know what I mean? It's kind of weird.
Right. Exactly. It's very weird. So,
the whole thing, even you're just one person, all of it was just marginalizing.
Marginalized entirely. So it goes.
Even the accusation of bullying.
Yes.
She wasn't bullying. She was saying, hey,
other people.
You said I'm one person. I'm
this.
Asking if there are other people. You accuse me of it being one person. So I'm saying if there are other people that aren't just me, let's tell her that it's not me. That's not fucking bullying.
No, it sure isn't.
Wow. You said it gets worse?
Yeah, it does get worse.
Continue.
So. After that, obviously, people are now like, Rosie.
Like, what the fuck, Rosie? Come on.
What are you doing, man? So once Lauren made a couple more, she kind of followed up that tweet just saying, like, I know what white people are doing when they say that to me certain way.
Of course, of course.
And it's not cute. It's meant to marginalize. And it's racist, you know? Like, you can't do that. I'm not stupid. Don't try and, like, pretend, like... it's not belittling and dehumanizing and infantilizing and mocking and degrading.
Absolutely.
Rosie writes back, at Chief Elk, at Chief Elk, at Chief Elk. Three times she writes her name.
Three separate tweets or just
yes,
one?
Yes. The one tweet, but she writes it three times to make it clear that Chief is in Lauren's handle.
Sure, sure.
I know what you mean. Women of color call me at Rosie all the time, ..
So now she's trying to... she tripled down on it. Someone should have just been like, take the phone for like 20. There needs to be like
no,
a,
because
a 24
look at,
hour
look
lockdown.
At, this is a real, this is, this entire situation is
it's a clear example of what white people do.
Not just white people, but white women in particular. And this issue between white women and women of color.
In the feminist movement.
Not just in the feminist movement, just generally speaking. Mm. I mean, obviously it shows itself in the feminist movement, but just generally speaking, that white women, because they are, oppressed, okay. Generally yeah, speaking, yeah. they are women,
and
so there
Rosie's
is there is a
the
level
LGBT
of
community.
Oppression that comes along
she
with
intersects.
That, and
yeah,
she
yeah.
is intersex as well. They refuse to acknowledge their privilege and see how they exude it because their whiteness still allows them privilege. And it is a huge problem. And in that exuding of their privilege, they completely erase the feelings, narrative, and importance of women of color on a consistent basis. And this is a clear example of exactly how it happens. Okay. Yeah. In real life and online and in media and all over the place.
In particular online, I saw the word and I didn't quite understand it fully. And I think this is a good example of maybe not misogynoir because that's particularly black women, but in this, what you're talking about with this women of color, in particular black women online, the intersection.
Well, Lauren's not black, so this
I understand. I'm saying that's why I said this doesn't apply, but women of color, you know, close on that scale of getting both misogyny and, you know, oppression based on another intersection.
Right, but I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about specifically white women's inability to see how their privilege shows itself in their interactions with women of color.
Okay.
That's what I'm talking about. And that's what this is a really good illustration of.
True.
All around. Okay, so she sends that at Chief Elk tweet, and somebody, another person on Twitter says, wow, LOL. That was really strong, Rosie. Is there an issue between you and women of color? You know, let's speak on it. Kind of opening the floor. Literally put the words LOL and wow in the tweet. So listen, I read it. You can see exactly the context that it was in. It was a response to this exchange. And to that, Rosie replies at Toussaint215, who is the person who tweeted her. Here I am, racist Rosie, on stage with the students in my school. And shows, it's a picture of her on stage with a bunch of brown and black children on a stage.
Is she doing like a Twitter, like many of my black friends are black? Like my friends are black? Like, look at this picture of me with some black people. Is that what she's doing? Literally like one of my friends is black.
Yes.
Okay.
Pretty much.
That's just straight out the playbook.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not trying to call her like a horrible person, but that's, you know, you see that every time. But one of my friends is black. Nah.
So it just started getting bigger and bigger, and people started, chiming in.
You and I are talking about
on both ends of the spectrum. People, you know,
oh, the defenders
standing for Rosie. You know, Rosie.
What was their take that she didn't mean it like that? She's a good person. What was their?
Well, the thing is, she puts racist Rosie, and Toussaint is like, I never said you were racist. I just said, do you have issues communicating with women of color, and can we talk about that? He's like, I take that charge very seriously, and I didn't hurl it at you. And the fact that you think a picture of you with black kids is supposed to be an answer to I don't know what is, well, now I'm like, damn, you are racist, because that's ridiculous.
Yeah, why'd you go there? And B, if you did go there, why is some like straw man photo evidence of you with a black person like supposedly a counter to that claim?
It's crazy.
This is like this isn't good PR wise for Rosie.
Of course, people are going back and forth about it. And one person was like, "Did Rosie just try and pull the I have a black friend and
for real?
So I'm not racist." So she says at J Dodd, "Yes, here I go again," and post a picture of a little black child in a box somewhere. I don't know. I guess it's somebody that she's personally involved with.
I there was someone, I have to find the article that, and I found it because I'm white, I'm not a person of color, I'm married to you, woman of color. And it was basically like, dear non-persons of color that, you know, date, marry, or whatever, black people, that doesn't give you a instant pass to not checking your privilege.
Nope.
You know?
I'd say the opposite, actually.
I kind of agree with you.
You better be checking that shit.
You check me. We just had this conversation the other day. You check me every day on the reg. You have no...
Right.
You're very direct about my privilege. And I'm not going to sit here and say it hasn't had consequences. And there hasn't been times where I've been like all in my feels about it. But the fuck? That's, you know, my very white penance. And that's my... I understand that. You know? Okay.
Well, of course, you can just see exactly where it would go from here, which is nowhere, you know.
Good,
basically. as you can imagine, it spirals. People are arguing back and forth. The person that she tweeted the second picture at says, one, do not use the black child for your racist rampage. Two, you're bold as hell. Rosie responds, fuck you.
No. Not she's done everything except like use epithets practically and literally like, you know, calling somebody a bitch or something. She's really gone kind of.
Yeah. So anyway, so the thing is that as this starts spiraling, and it's one thing to talk about whatever happened with Rosie, but I wanted to kind of set the stage for an interaction that I noticed in the midst of all this, because people are now going back and forth, defending Rosie, not defending, arguing with people, telling them why, you know, women of color shouldn't be upset about this and why they should and da-da-da-da-da.
And it's going to be always white people telling people of color what they should and shouldn't
which
feel.
Which is exactly the point that I was going to go to, which is there a woman, she was defending Rosie. And she was talking with a person whose handle is at mojon851010.
So now this is in the thread of people going back and forth.
Yes, in the thread.
So now we're like sub-tweeting.
Sub-tweeting.
Okay.
But on the front end, it says fists up, fight back is the name. Okay. So she says, you're all about hate. Why can't you be about love?
I just had that rant like 2 days ago about fucking everybody. I just go on.
And Mojon's like, what are you talking about? She says, even your name is about fighting. Guess you always have to win. Sad. You miss out on a lot of chances to love.
Sad. Oh.
Mojon says, my name is about the love of my people. But since you don't see us as anything more than props, that would be sad to you. And the woman replies, why does your love for your people come through as fighting instead of loving and including all?
That was the exact, honestly, I ranted on that like 2 days ago. Just this whole, you're being divisive. It's like, listen, me calling out like racist shit is the exact antithesis and opposite of anything divisive and racist. I do it because I love black people and I love you too. Whoever says something, I you know, if I say something offensive, like I hope you love me enough. You're like, whoa, Drew. You know what I mean? Like, it's not like, this is crazy.
So anyways, this really, this guy, I don't even know him, but his handle is Alendrel, A-L-E-N-D-R-E-L, steps into the conversation, a white man. He says, because maybe they have to fight to survive in a world that's had it out for them. The white woman replies, maybe. Alendrel says, spoiler, maybe. Not maybe, absolutely, yes.
He set her up with like the racial version of like a D's nuts.
Literally.
That was like
she
a bofa.
Replies, my point was that I wish they did not always have to fight. He replies,
me too.
How do you think they feel?
Oh my God.
She says, I get it. I just think sometimes they, in quotes, can't see when that they are fighting allies, not enemies.
Ooh.
He replies, and they sure as fuck know who their allies are a lot better than you or I.
White people.
She says, sometimes you can end up boxing a shadow.
She's going. She's trying to, you know what it is?
She is going hilt to hilt.
Let me
finish it because I want to get through it. He says, last retweet. This woman knows more about people of color combating their oppression than people of color do. She says, you are wrong. I do not know more. I do not know what it's like to be put down. I do know what it's like to be put down. Do not call the dogs. He says, yet here you are policing them. She says, policing who? He says, the black people you are tut-tutting for fighting too much. Not at all, she says. He posts her original tweet telling them that you're all about fighting. You need to be all about love. Silence.
Of course.
So I just wanted to give him a shout out because I just thought it was such a like complete decimation of her. I don't know if she really realized it or I feel like you can't read that and not be like, oh yeah, everything he's saying is completely logical. And yeah, crazy.
I've stopped engaging like, you know, I would say like low level trolls. Right. And in the beginning I was just fighting with anybody and everybody. And I would see this all the time where somebody would make a kind of an illogical statement. They're kind of amped or whatever. They tweet something. And then over a period of like not even long, like 10 tweets, it wouldn't have to take very, very long. They paint themselves like twittering into a corner that they can't get out of. And then they're forced to defend this like really illogical position. And they're like, I didn't even fucking, what are you talking about? And like, here's your timeline. What the fuck? Like you said this like not even 10 tweets ago. All the time. I think it's a very white thing. And it stems, you know, I've talked a little bit about this, like are, you know, my people, white people, we want to be seen as good. We always want to be seen as good. And there's even this nature like, oh, come on, stop fighting. Like, I'm trying to be the, you know, the referee. I'm going to be a good person. And then when it's pointed out that, like, what you did was kind of shitty, you're like, well, no, but I'm not. I'm a good person. And then you're defending what you did in a very – you're defending it not from a pragmatic or logical position. You're defending it from an emotional position. And every time you defend it into a – fucking corner that's like, oops.
Always. So again, all of this happened between February, on February 5th, 9 in the morning, and went through the evening and into the morning and afternoon on the 6th. At 10:10 p.m. on the 6th of February, The View tweets, Rosie returns Monday to The View for her final week. She'll be back often with her unique point of view and updates on her work and family. For personal health and family reasons, our teammate Rosie O'Donnell has decided to leave our show.
No way. So she got shit canned or she's quitting?
Well, they say she's quitting.
They would never.
She's also breaking up with her wife, apparently. But I don't know. That's not anything to do with this story. But I just wanted to give a little bookend. I think it's interesting that here she's being called to carpet for her bullshit, racist-ass behavior. And now she's like, oh, I'm not going to put myself on TV anymore. La la.
Well, you don't know how that's all going on. They might have asked her to leave.
Well, how convenient.
And you're talking about her relationship breaking up, not being, you know, relevant. It may, and I'm not trying to defend Rosie, that's a stressor. You're in your life, you're
stressed.
They
broke up in November.
I understand.
But, I'm just saying, it wasn't yesterday.
I understand, but she's clearly under some stress. And
aren't we all?
I understand.
We all under stress. She ain't under that much stress. She don't got to worry about where she's feeding her kids.
She does.
She's not going to worry. She's not worried about somebody shooting her.
What she got to worry about
because she was walking down a street.
She got to worry about that kid in that box.
She's not worried about being killed and nobody giving a shit what her name is.
@Rosie.
So I think she's doing all right.
So let's switch up a little later. Did you see the Jimmy Kimmel bit where he's asking white people if they have a black friend?
I did see it. It was really funny.
I thought it was kind of hilarious. But so we don't have to see all the white people. There was the typical, like, so they went on the street, the feet on the street.
Just play the one guy is the best.
Well, I'm going to play the black guy when they found the black guy because I think that's the best.
He gets double points for that. Who else do we have out on the boulevard?
Linwood from Virginia.
I didn't have to tell you his black name. Linwood.
The definite, like, old white, old black dude's name. Even though I'm saying old. But go ahead.
White friends?
Oh. Linwood from Virginia have any white friends?
Yes.
He does. All right, let's see.
No, not really.
Why not?
I don't know. White people
kind of
scary.
White people kind of scary.
Hard to argue, Jimmy says.
Hi, Isabel from New York City.
Do you have a black friend?
Does Isabel?
New York.
Everyone
in New York has a black friend. I just don't believe that you can live in New York and not have a New York City and not have a black friend. It's impossible.
Yeah.
What's their name?
Tyrone.
Is it just one?
No, I have a lot of black friends.
Prove it.
How?
Are they in your phone?
Yeah.
He takes the phone.
Tyrone, hello? Tyrone. Hey, what's happening, man? You black? Are you black? All right, cool. Sweet. Peace.
You know what I liked about the bit is that it was – It was what comedians do really well sometimes with social commentary.
Yeah.
And then it was a little bit kind of awkward and biting and uncomfortable.
Sure.
But it was good in that.
And it was funny. And I think they got a good – I don't know how many people they ended up asking, but I thought they had a really good sampling of people
sure.
that were like, yeah, I do have a black friend. And the one white dude, the older white dude,
yeah,
I thought he was the funniest one because
stammered.
He was like, yeah, yeah. And he's like, really? What's their name? And he was like,
He's like looking around. He's
We're
like
gonna take that
for
as a no. He was sitting there going, "Does the janitor count? Let me."
He wasn't
think
saying
about,
the janitor. He was saying something.
Does the gardener? Does that? Oh no. Mm-mm. Let me think about this. What about that guy at the coffee shop? Like, I know that's what he was doing, running down in his mind the black people that he interacts with, and could he truthfully consider them friends? And the answer to that question is a big fat no. Hilaire.
No.
Also, this week was. The Honorable Robert Nesta Marley's birthday.
70.
It would have been his 70th birthday. As you know, I love Bob, of course, and all things Jamaica. And so it was great to kind of see people celebrating him in lots of different ways. I changed my Facebook page and I posted a bunch of stuff. And we listened to recently released Uprising Live album that was just released on CD and DVD that was filmed in Germany in 1980. So that was really cool. We listened to it on this birthday.
And
yeah, it was really cool. But I found this rare, very rare, Tuff Gong studio rehearsal from 1980 of him with the boys. So I'm going to play it. So let's
do it.
Let's listen.
The high yellow moon won't come out to play. Darkness has covered my life.
I'll put the link to the full song, but it's pretty fucking amazing. First of all, the band is just insane. Peter Tosh, I mean, they're just so tight. Bonnie Wailer, they're amazing. And then this is just them in the studio, just rehearsing, you know.
Yeah.
Knocking it out, just chilling around, sitting, you know, playing together.
When he I remember maybe this is his birthday?
Yes.
Yeah, I remember birthday. The day he died was commemorated. We listened to his last concert from Pittsburgh.
Yes.
And that was also 1980. So yes. This must have been one of the last sort of studio recordings that they have.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Yeah, I think I tweeted something like, you know, his message of uprising and struggle and love is needed now more than ever.
Oh, gosh, yeah. I can only imagine what a huge force that he would be in the Black Lives Matter movement and and also work he would have done in between now and then and now anyway, in general. You know, he just...
Yeah.
Anyway.
Speaking of spurious segues.
Yeah.
Jamaica and weed and Illinois marijuana bill. Did you hear that?
I heard about that.
Yeah. So they're trying to... Illinois... and I'll just read it real quick. Adults in Illinois would be able to use small amounts of recreational marijuana without fear of jail time under two bills introduced by the General Assembly. The bills are the first ever legislation in the state aimed at rolling back marijuana-related penalties. So Senate Bill 753, sponsored by State Senate Michael Noland, would make it legal for anyone over 21 to possess more than 30 grams of marijuana, and it would permit the production and possession of up to 5 marijuana plants. Now, some detractors, like even Illinois' Chapter of Normal, says it's decriminalization on steroids. You're completely removing the criminal penalties for low-level possession, but you still haven't changed anything for the higher possession amounts or the commercial market or taxation.
Right.
But again, and I think the reason for the attacking at the lower level first is just the vast disparity with which arrests occur. In fact, Illinois is number 3 on, I would say, a very dubious distinction. So in terms of all 50 states, we know as a fact white individuals and black individuals use marijuana specifically at almost virtually identical rates. So if you look at the ratio of the population, you see how more often people of color and black people are arrested. And Illinois is number 3 on the list with an arrest disparity of 7.6-1.
Right.
Nationwide, Illinois is among the highest. And it's because of the Chicago and the segregation city. So I think attacking the low-level possession, it's fantastic. I think it's
more of a decriminalization angle than a legalization angle. But I do think that, I mean, honestly, there's a map that shows the African-American share of population where they're concentrated, and then the marijuana arrests between 2011 and 2014. And it's like, it's the same map.
It's as if it was a Venn diagram, it'd be two overlapping circles.
Overlapping completely.
But that's because Chicago's very segregated. I think it's one of the, at one point it used to be home to, I think like 3 or 4 of the poorest neighborhoods in the whole country.
Right.
Just because of our housing projects and the history in Chicago, contract lending, all kinds of, you know, shit that's gone on.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's just economically. Think about the police and law enforcement resources and legal and all that, you know, and if it's under 30 ounces, they're not, you know, that's a nonviolent, simple possession. There's another bill that would change it. So instead of making it completely legal, would do what a lot of cities like Philadelphia has done.
Well, it's like a ticket.
It's like a municipal, like a civil infraction.
Well, it's just interesting. I mean, we were talking, I think we were watching, I don't know, I was watching Mob Wives or something. And one of the women on the show is like, she lives in Arizona and she was thinking about putting together a legal marijuana dispensary business. And I was, we sat there looking at each other and I said, man, 5 years ago, would you have ever imagined anybody on television talking about it, something like
a
this?
A plot line.
No way.
Yeah.
No way. I think it's just, and then this whole thing with Jeb Bush came out, you know, I feel like there's been like,
oh, the increasing, like I didn't inhale.
I kind of inhaled.
I ripped bong hits for a living.
Of course I did. And Jeb Bush was like, yeah, I was a total pothead in college. Like, really? You're a stoner?
That's called college.
Yeah.
But no, I think it's a great step for the city of Chicago. And I applaud them for putting those measures forward. And I think you're seeing it in a lot of big cities.
Yeah.
It's just, and it's about fucking time. The war on drugs, in particular when it comes to marijuana, is just an abject failure.
It is. It's abject failure across the board.
It is, absolutely.
You don't need to quantify it. It just is an abject failure.
Fair enough. It's an abject failure.
Full stop.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's crazy. Absolutely crazy. Mm-hmm. So, this isn't really news, but you hear about Serena Williams.
She's a boss.
She is
winning the freaking Australian Open.
Again,
beating Sharapova.
This is her.
She's been kicking that chick's ass for years.
This is her sixth Australian Open win.
That's her tournament, though.
Major. At Australian Open. It's the 15th straight time she's beat Sharapova, spanning a decade. Puts Serena in number two all-time position, her 19th major, second all-time, only behind Steffi Graf with 22. She just passed Chris Evert and Martina Navratilova.
What is she, 30?
I don't know her exact age. I have to look it up. I don't think it matters.
It does matter.
Boss.
Don't say that. It definitely matters.
She's at the twilight of a tennis career, perhaps. But
I wouldn't say that. I mean, I think she'll decide when she's at the twilight of it.
Shit, yeah.
She's 33.
What'd you say?
She's 33.
You and I have talked a little bit before about how she gets kind of a, you know.
Sharapova is 27, just giving you some. I say it matters because I think that's significant to say that a 27, 33-year-old, two women, top of their sport, she's beat her every time
her
for the
life.
Last 10 years.
Basically, Sharapova's entire adult life.
You ain't catching up.
To Serena Williams.
Yeah, you ain't catching up on this one.
Well, and we've talked before about how Serena gets, like, when she had a little bit of a, I don't even call it a bad stretch. The media tried to say because she's trying to win all these majors. She's second all time. And she was stuck at tied with Navratilova and Evert for a while. Mm-hmm. And it took her to beat it, to get there. And there's all this, like, oh, she hasn't won. It was like 9 months and she hadn't won a major, right? Like, the fuck? Like, someone doesn't win a major
ever
in a nine-month span.
Some of them win one goddamn major. Most of the people that started playing tennis with her, Lindsay Davenport, all of those kinds of people.
Ain't win shit.
They ain't win shit. You know what they're doing right now? They're coaching or they're moms. I'm not joking.
So
they no longer play tennis professionally.
So I think Serena gets a hard rap when it's in the other direction, and she doesn't get lifted enough in this direction.
Yeah, lift her up.
I know. I want to say it was barely a blip on the radar, but how many people knew that she won the Australian Open?
Black people knew. Don't sleep.
Unfortunately, black people don't run the media.
Well, I knew. People was
your media
clapping. Clapping for her.
So I'm just going to lift up Serena because I fucking
love her. You're badass.
Yeah.
This morning, Tyler Perry on Facebook posted a picture, a selfie of himself in a grocery store.
Doing what?
He says, I haven't been in a supermarket in 15 years.
That's what I was thinking.
I can't find a darn thing. LOL.
I said doing what? Because I was like, the fuck? He hasn't been in a grocery store since he got rich as shit.
I'm going to give a shout out to Raquel MacArthur Jackson, who brought this to my attention. She posted it with her words. When I become rich, can y'all please remind me not to let 15 years go by? So I just thought it was funny, like, just the lack of self-awareness to post it, not to have the realization, because let's be serious. He has no idea how food gets in his house.
Not a fucking clue. It shows up.
He doesn't even know how food gets on his plate.
It's like the Jetsons. You press a button.
He sits down and it appears. So let's keep it real. And that's fine. That's the life he lives. That's great. But don't come. Look, we know you haven't been to the grocery store, Tyler. You don't need to make sure we know it. We're aware.
It's his Facebook. What the fuck? I'm not going to be all shitty with him.
I'm not shitty. I just think it just shows a lack of self-awareness. That's all I was saying.
We have a friend that is of means, and we've talked about the awareness that is difficult for someone in a small town of means. Just always constantly, you can't ever make any sort of – it's hard to be yourself. And so I feel a little bit bad that he's in a grocery store. Like, he's even being self-deprecating and making fun of himself. And even in that, it's like, oh, you're still being elitist. I don't know.
I didn't say he was being elitist. I said he had a lack of self-awareness. That's all I said.
Okay. It
was a humble brag. Come on. That's what it was.
A little bit of a humble brag.
Let's call a thing. I didn't say it was elitist. I'm just saying we all knew this shit. So why are you telling us for? Like, the sky is blue. No shit, Tyler. I'm aware that the sky is blue and you don't buy your groceries.
I would almost say for me, like, not like hashtag life goals, because I'm not about, you know, like being rich and money and famous or whatever. But if I had so much money, my life goal would be to not have so much that I would not know what it'd be like to be in a grocery store for 15 years. So I can agree with that girl. Like, if I make it, y'all don't fucking let me get, like, you know, bloviated and let 15 years go by before I step into a fucking Costco. Right. You know what I mean? Like, if I can't fucking transact groceries, something's wrong.
And plus, I just think it's ridiculous anyways. Like, first of all, grocery stores haven't changed that much in 15 years. Like,
Listen, Linda, listen. I go from one Wegmans to another and I'm fucking lost.
But
I don't know where my Wegmans
signs where it is. That's not an equation of like, oh, I can't find a doctor. Like, it's just an unnecessary thing to say is all I mean.
Maybe if he hadn't shared it publicly.
That's what I mean. I'm saying you can have that moment for yourself, but don't post it on Facebook. In other news of people being idiots in media and television and wherever, you know, Anthony Mackie's been having problems lately.
Well, and this is actually, let's call a thing a thing. I've been hearing on The Black Guy Who Tips and a bunch of other places, make daddy a sandwich.
Yeah.
And someone's like, that's the fucking quote of the year. And I've been like, yeah, that's kind of funny. And you're like, well, Anthony Mackie said, I'm like, what are you talking about? I don't understand exactly when on the Wendy Williams show. So I knew it's almost like having an awareness that the phrase sour grapes means like you're upset about something,
but not knowing
the fable that's behind sour grapes. So like I have this, but that's my whiteness.
Yeah, that is your whiteness. You're outside of the
Anthony
Mackie.
So bring me in the circle.
Bubble.
Bring me in the circle.
So yeah, he went on the Wendy Williams show.
How you doing?
Promoting his whatever. I guess that black and white movie. And they were talking about quite a few things, and they went to a discussion on relationships. Getting to it, here we go. Oops. Let's see. I think it's right around here.
When they had the Sony hackation,
right,
there was a note in there
Washington.
About Denzel,
like,
Washington.
They're like, Denzel Washington is not a star around the world.
He's not bankable over there.
Yeah.
He's
and
bankable
I'm like,
here.
Because when I walk out of my hotel
in Europe,
it's a whole different ball game. So I know if Denzel walking down
what
the
is
street,
he talking about right now?
Carjacking and kidnapping.
And a lot of times, like, Idris Elba has the English accent.
Right.
So somehow that works over there.
Well, they believe, yes.
Yes, yes. So now, Anthony Mackie, as many times as we've talked, I don't think that I've ever acknowledged that you've been with the same girl since second grade.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Second grade's a little creepy.
It's adorable.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
When he was in second grade, too.
I know.
Yeah.
Okay.
Still mean. She's still like a 7-year-old. It's the same. Like,
now that's creepy.
Same mean. She's still,
yeah. That's you.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's nice because Hollywood is such a head trip.
Right.
That you actually are with somebody who's seen you do it all and somebody who you can't front on, like when you get home.
100%. And that's what's so great. Like,
yes.
You know, we go to the movies together. We watch all our movies together. And she's like my normal person's eyes and ears, you know?
And I hear
like he's not normal?
You and I have something in common. You believe
in a lot of cases
that men and women have roles.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Well, you say,
oh, yeah.
You better believe it. I'm from this. Yeah, you better believe it.
I mean, you're from New Orleans. Yeah. I'm only from Jersey.
Yeah,
but I do believe that if he wants a sandwich,
you make daddy a sandwich. No.
Here we
go.
Watch.
Let me ask you this. Well, okay. Let me ask you this. If me and you out and somebody say something slick to you,
you punch him in the face.
You want me to smack him in his mouth, right?
That's right.
So if I take you on a date and I say, look, baby, we're going to go Dutch.
No.
Exactly. If we walking up to the car and I don't open your car door, what do you say?
Open the door.
You better believe it.
Yeah, no, I am with you. I think
so. You make daddy a sandwich.
I will after I get out of the shower.
Anthony Mackie.
So I just wanted to play it for you because you hadn't heard it.
You make daddy a sandwich.
Make daddy a sandwich, idiot.
Were people going in on him?
Oh my gosh, it's the most ridiculous thing ever. Just the use of the daddy is just gross and ridiculous. And no. My whole thing was like, his girl is not making him a fucking sandwich for a long goddamn time. Because you know he got home and she was like, Anthony, I don't make you no goddamn sandwiches around here. Why you got these people out in the world thinking that I'm here making you sandwiches?
You know how like Rod does like voices and shit?
Right.
I didn't realize that he was, that Mackie had said it with his chest, right?
Oh, yeah.
He's got all like, you know.
Make daddy a sandwich.
As I thought Rod was just making fun of him.
Oh, oh no, it's a direct impression.
That's good.
Shout out to Rod.
In fact, why don't we have that as a soundbite? Make daddy a sandwich. You can play it to me anytime.
Okay.
Tell me to make daddy a sandwich.
I don't know about that. I think we can leave Mackie off of the...
The John, make daddy a sandwich?
Yeah.
Well, speaking of stuff that's been going on, where's my...
Uh-oh.
I think Mackie's
okay,
back in
okay. No, he's just stupid.
So, Obese.
Yeah.
Obese be steady rolling.
Lame duck blackness.
Lame duck blackness. So, he was once again at the, he did his annual, there's a national prayer breakfast.
Right.
It's held by the Fellowship Foundation, otherwise known as the Family. It's a super secret Christian.
Yeah, you're like creeped out by them. Didn't you read a book about them or something?
I did. Don't talk
too much about it. They might like sock us or something.
Are
they like Scientologists?
No, they're a very powerful, very connected, politically well-appointed, super Christian, very wealthy.
Oh, so like a pack.
Yeah.
Okay, got it.
But they have like a townhouse.
I got
you. Called the farm or whatever. But this book that's about them, like it. Don't talk about him.
Okay. Yeah. As I said, don't talk about
him. So he's at their annual prayer breakfast.
Right.
Like a sitting president from like fucking Eisenhower forward has done at least once in their term the annual prayer breakfast.
Right.
So Obese's at the – I shouldn't say President Obama. Forgive me.
Well, he's only Obese in the context of lame duck blackness.
You're right. Obese came out. So he's at this prayer thing and he literally goes into a long, like a good like three – and you should listen to the whole thing, but a good like 3-minute speech about fundamentalism and religion and some of the problems, and that it's not just Islam and, you know, with fundamentalist groups that are, you know, in the name of religion carrying out atrocities. He was like, listen, you know, the Crusades has been on. So I'll just play a little bit of a clip. But again, to put it in context, he's saying this at the like secret like Fellowship Family, like uber super Christian, like they believe they own the Ten Commandments, like God's law is
like, but you know what? He won both of them. So
here we go. His president's words.
Yeah.
And lest we get on our high horse and think this is unique to some other place, remember that during the Crusades and the Inquisition, people committed terrible deeds in the name of Christ.
Oh, snap. Pin drop.
In our home country,
a pause.
Slavery and Jim Crow all too often was justified in the name of Christ.
A little Martin in his voice right there. Justified.
Michelle and I returned from India.
He said, in the name of Christ, there's that pause again. His eyes like darted around. Like,
he's like, yep.
Step.
Talking about you.
Step. I am talking about this here. Got all serious. I love it.
Oh, yeah.
It really, that eye roll should be, someone's got to gift that. Be like,
yes.
In the name of Christ.
It was real quiet in there, though, huh?
Well,
I think he was really more addressing, like, the, you know, anti-Muslim and Islamophobic issues that have arisen recently. And, you know, just, I think in the context of a prayer breakfast, I think it's pretty freaking appropriate. Of course, the right wing.
Well, I was going to say, you said it was a pin drop quiet in the room.
Yeah.
Once these motherfuckers got out.
Oh, yeah.
The headline of this bitch was the most offensive thing I've ever heard a president make in my lifetime.
Ever?
Yeah. The most offensive statement ever. I've ever heard a president make in my lifetime.
When Andrew Jackson said he wanted to go kill all the Indians, that wasn't offensive?
Honestly, too, with the, because President Obama has this lingering, like, Muslim.
Teddy Roosevelt, anti-trans. Gender individuals?
Most offensive. Well, might not have been his lifetime. Okay. This guy's lifetime.
Got
whoever this guy is.
Oh, in his life.
Yeah.
Okay, I got it.
That's the qualification.
All right.
But so, you know how Obama gets the whole, you know, he's a Muslim and, you know, the birther bullshit. So for now,
I did not have sex with that woman.
So for Obama to be speaking powerfully about, you know, these things in particular, comparing, you know, be honest, fundamentalist movements in organized Islam, compared to fundamentalist movements and organized Christianity. People just got all in their field.
Hey, he's just following the pontiff's lead. He just said that 2 weeks ago. So
absolutely.
Let's
good
just
company.
Keep it real.
Good company.
He got the ear of Christ, last I heard.
Good company.
So just saying.
One more time. Yeah, you
what's
are,
up?
Obama.
What's up?
Wouldn't have it any other way, baby.
Okay, okay.
Yeah.
I want both of them. So I wanted to just touch very briefly on this story that has been just, I would say, in all the tabloids and everywhere about Bruce Jenner and his, I would say, alleged transition from male to female. I know that he is going to be sitting, having a sit down with Diane Sawyer. It's going to be airing in May to discuss his situation and kind of have the ability to talk about what's going on with him. And I actually just wanted to, Rod and Karen talked about it on the Black Guy Who Tips show this morning,
Feedback show.
Because somebody else was talking about it. And Rod, you know, brought some really always great points up about, you know, just the way people have been talking about it. These tabloids have just been horrible with Photoshop photos and just, it's just a really like offensive
way to do business
and to just be about it. So I actually don't want to talk about Bruce at all, except for that. I am glad that, we will have the opportunity to hear from him, whatever he wants to share. And, I think it's important to just have the ability to have that on the record so that people can react appropriately. Yeah. So
I don't know if, and I'm not talking about him, but in general, it's so insensitive, you know, for an individual to be going through, and we don't know, right? You said the right word, allegedly.
Allegedly.
It's even speculation.
It is. It's all a speculation, you know, it's
but
just inappropriate.
Someone at whatever stage in their life where they're dealing with, you know, anything, much less something, you know, as deeply personal as gender identity, to be even just talking about it, it's just fucking, it's just gotta be horrible. And I think that he gets it because the Kardashian TV show, there's a national discourse that's comfortable, used to, expecting, and very
to
normal
critique
to,
them
to be
strongly.
Just bashing Kim and company
absolutely.
Over the head. And with the, they put themselves out there, they, you know,
they deserve it.
Right. They, you know,
I don't subscribe to that, but yeah.
You do subscribe to that?
No, I do not.
You're not.
I do not.
Well, on some level, there's a little bit like, okay, you make your money off of being in the tabloids and you leverage the tabloids when you want, but it's hard for them to then just say, hey, I want my privacy. I appreciate that.
I ascribe to the notion that they have made a decision to make not a lot of themselves private, but that doesn't change the fact
that
they
make everything fair game.
Exactly. I don't think those two things are mutually exclusive. They're still individuals and people. And I mean, it's crazy.
And honestly, California's got the strictest laws when it comes to privacy and HIPAA and all those kind of things. They lead the nation in that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And they're in California and he's still getting, you know, people in terms of the speculation, things that you just shouldn't know.
Right.
And it's like, that's not right. That's not right.
Yeah.
You know?
Well,
but
anyways, I'm glad he's going to be taking an opportunity to speak about whatever the case may be. But I wanted to talk about it a little bit in the context of just, the fluidity, or I guess the change in the conversation with regard to gender assignment and gender identity roles and spaces in which those conversations are needed, necessary, and how complicated they can be. Because I think that's the only good thing to take from, you know, hearing Bruce talk about whatever's going on with him with Diane Sawyer is going to be a public and very open, hopefully, discussion about this and what that could mean for the larger conversation in the country and the world and you know, popular vernacular about people that have made the decision to transition. So, you know, I went to an all-girls boarding school, and when I was there, and in fact, while I was there, the Gay Straight Alliance, you know, like group, you know, they have, you know, clubs, I guess it would be called appropriately, was formed like my sophomore or junior year. So prior to that, they didn't even have a formal group that spoke to people that were LGBT at all. And so I call attention to that. I'm pretty old. So I had my 20th anniversary or reunion last year. So it's been a long time. But in talking with one of the administrators who is there now, she mentioned that it's so different. You know, we just started that club now, and now being out and being a lesbian on campus or, you know, at school is totally normal. Nobody even thinks anything of it, and it's completely not unusual and
right.
completely, you know, nobody even bats an eyelash at it. But they have recently had to, I wouldn't call them issues, but they've had to deal with two students that have made the decision to transition at the school.
During their tenure.
Okay. So one was a senior and about to leave. And, you know, kind of the school had sort of taken this idea of, like, if you're transitioning, so you haven't gotten to your destination yet, this is a welcome place. But it's difficult in an all-girls boarding school environment to have someone who identifies as male going there. I hope I'm explaining it correctly in terms of how I see it. Anyways.
Well, I think, and I, from the school standpoint, I think, you know, when you and I talked about it, and people should be aware, the school is about as, you know, as progressive as you're ever going to find. Like the education that, that women receive there and the individual they matriculate, incredible. So I think when I hear there's an issue with the school having someone who identifies as a male matriculate from the institution, it's not that they have an issue with that individual.
Right.
It's an issue with what they're trying to provide as an all-girls academy.
Exactly.
And when someone identifies as male, you're no longer in the definition of the umbrella of what is an all-girl by your own desires. And they want to respect that. You've transitioned and you've now asked to be, you know, gender male pronouns and names and all sorts of, you know, probably even bathrooms and all kinds of, and you know.
And rightfully so.
And they would want to really respect that. And I think that they, under their umbrella of a all-girls education, that becomes in their mind, not possible.
Right.
So I can see that.
The young woman that was a senior that transitioned to be a young man left, graduated, and it was an issue. But the other student was a freshman. And it was really difficult for the school because the school seeks to provide a very nurturing environment for the students. And the goal is to put you in a position to, you know, fully realize your actual self, to empower all that you are, to you know, be authentic in, you know,
right.
stand in your power. And for someone who would want to transition, that environment should stimulate that process.
I was going to say, it's almost paradoxically.
I think that it would certainly be like, oh, they look
all
at all of
that.
This stuff.
Yeah.
It's about me being me and me being myself and coming to terms with what that means. Just anybody, as you're an adolescent, it's something you have to come to terms with. And so it doesn't surprise me that somebody would come into the environment that's provided there and get that experience and come out of it saying, yes,
have the space that's available for them to come to this moment
for themselves and decide to transition.
But that's the paradox, is that the school would not only matriculate, it would absolutely support vociferously 1,000,000% a woman, a young woman's interest, desire, the space to be able to explore their own gender identity. But the moment that that individual has decided that identity is male, all of a sudden, you know what I mean? It's almost, I get it, and I can see that being very difficult for all parties.
Yeah.
For even the individual, the student, it being difficult, like, wow, I've been supported and nurtured and everything up until now, this very moment.
Right.
That's got to be kind of tough.
Yeah. So, but anyways, my point is that it's it does come into some complex areas, but I think that it's conversations that are going to be had more. I think that it's going to, and I think that's a good thing, because I think that we need to recognize all that people are and all that they bring as themselves into the world. And so, you know, the blurring of those lines to me only is a good thing. And I just want to acknowledge those conversations are taking place, like the one that Rod had on the Black Guy Who Tips today, just discussing what's appropriate, what's not, how, you know, we should be respectful of the way people want to self-identify, whether that be gender or race or whatever it might be. And you know, giving people the respect that they deserve when it comes to
Absolutely.
Something so private and personal. So,
and, you know, we had on my timeline today, had a bunch of different discussions, a little bit about Rosie and then, you know, her response and, you know, all sorts of things about privilege and this and that. And there was an individual, I'll just lift her up. I can't remember her, I didn't ask her first name, but her handle is Global Lang MTL. So she's a language researcher in Canada. So I assume in Montreal, but had a lot of really good insight and input into specifically the historical context with which language has been used and how it changes over time and shapes. And there was a piece that someone was talking about, you know, race, obviously, because that's a lot of what my timeline talks about, but that white is the only designation from 1790 forward in the census that's never changed at all. It's been steady from, you know, 300 years practically, whereas every, you know, you look at, you know, Negro, slave, octoroon, color, all sorts of designations for people of color, black people, all throughout the census. White.
And so, I think there, even at one point, wasn't there like European? I thought that they had like some sort, because if they
sure,
were
how
like
the Irish,
immigrants.
How the Irish became white.
Yeah, they had to.
Absolutely.
And then they transitioned them and then they pulled that category
away. Absolutely. How the Irish became white. It's a book.
Or Italian
that.
Or whoever. Yeah. Well, so Polish, the, whatever.
But so she had some really good insight and said that a lot of emerging conversations around this is really trying to push forward when it talks about things that are possessive, using gender neutral, their, they. Mm-hmm. And I remember for a while,
people.
I was in my own maturation within, you know, whatever I do, whether it be work, business, life, I'm writing a Facebook post, a personal email. I've seen the evolution of his or her, him/her, you know, him or her, to really, I remember there was a period where it skewed to she.
Right.
It was like, well, if I don't want, him or her is linguistically cumbersome and I don't want to say him or her, so I'm just going to pick a female one.
Right.
Right. Just out of, you know, deference to the fact that it's almost always the male, I'm going to go out of my way to say she. And now it's going even, I think, a little bit more in the right direction and being they or there. I think it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, I do.
I told her I'm intrigued by her research and to keep me posted. So Global Lang MTL, we're looking forward to hearing more.
Yeah. So I saw this really interesting article about addiction.
Yeah, you told me this like a while ago and we never talked about it.
It's really something like – it's kind of crazy.
A new paradigm.
Cause, yeah, talking about the cause of addiction.
And we say cause meaning like there's the disease model, there's the other models of addiction. Is that okay.
So this is by Johan Hari, and he wrote a book called Chasing the Stream, The First and Last Days of the War on Drugs, and kind of went through figuring out what's really driving the drug war and kind of went into all of this different stuff. And talked a little bit about kind of, you know, those early days of, you know, the drug-free America, like, this is your brain on drugs, you know, that whole thing. And then they had the experiment. It was like in the 80s with the rats where they put a rat in a cage with two bottles of water. One's just water. The other one's laced with heroin and cocaine. And every time the rat will become obsessed with the drug water and keep coming back for more and more. So it kills itself.
I remember as a kid, you know, I grew up in the 70s, that research was used by those like anti-drug ads and like that I don't call it propaganda, but I knew and I was aware of, if given a choice, two organisms in a cage, water, cocaine water, one will give up, they would say like sex, food, every other stimulant, and only do cocaine until they die. Like this was like kind of known like research, like,
right.
You know what I mean? Like,
yeah. The advert said, only one drug is so addictive, 9 out of 10 laboratory rats will use it and use it and use it until dead.
Yeah.
It's called cocaine and it can happen to you too.
That's it. So my point being, I didn't at that time know anything about research methodology, but I knew that. I knew that piece of information.
In the 70s, a professor of psychology in Vancouver, shout out to Canada again, called Bruce Alexander, noticed something odd about the experiment. The rat is in the cage all alone. It has nothing to do but take the drugs. What would happen, he wondered, if we tried this differently? So he built a rat park, this huge cage with like colored balls and all like rat food and tunnels, basically rat Disneyland, okay?
And so, again, I'm trying to understand the difference between the first experiment and now.
So the first experiment was just an empty cage with just the two water bottles. That's it. That's all that the rat had.
So it was like a rat dystopia, right? Like you're living under the – you got
and your
nothing.
Choice is like
a van down by the river and cocaine.
And cocaine. That's it.
Okay.
Okay.
And then the new one is like rat Shangri-La.
Rat Shangri-La. So he wondered what would happen if he tried the same experiment.
Very interesting.
Okay. So in the rat park, all the rats obviously tried both water bottles but because they didn't know what was in them. And that's when – something startling happened. The rats with good lives didn't like the drugged water. They mostly shunned it, consuming less than a quarter of the drugs the isolated rats use. None of them died. While all the rats who were alone and unhappy became heavy users, none of the rats who had a happy environment did. At first, they thought it was just a quirk of the rats. That's what the author thought.
Sure, maybe it was like this rat or that rat. I gotcha.
Until she discovered that there was, at the same time as the Rat Park experiment, a helpful human equivalent taking place. It was called the Vietnam War. Time magazine reported using heroin as, quote, as common as chewing gum among U.S. soldiers. And there is solid evidence to back this up. Some 20% of U.S. soldiers had become addicted to heroin there, according to published archives of the Archives of General Psychiatry. Many people were understandably terrified. They believed a huge number of addicts were about to head home when the war ended. But in fact, some 95% of the addicted soldiers, according to the same study, simply stopped. Very few had rehab. They shifted from a terrifying cage back to a pleasant one, and so they didn't need the drug anymore.
So the rat Shangri-La versus the rat cage, the analogy is your life as a civilian, your life in the Vietnam War as a soldier.
Correct.
Makes a lot of sense.
Okay. So that was the first phase of the rat park. So Professor Alexander took it even further. He reran the experiments where they were left alone and became compulsive users. He let them use for 57 days. If anything can get you hooked, it's that. Okay. Then he took them out of isolation and put them in the rat park. He wanted to know if you could fall into the state of addiction, if your brain is hijacked so you can't recover. Do the drugs take over? What happens?
That's a really good sort of – it's not – now he's trying to eliminate the possibility that it was the
– chemical.
Or the Shangri-La from the beginning. Right. Like, you know, does the rat Shangri-La, does the environment have such an impact on your level of addictability? Mm-hmm. I guess if that's the right word, right?
Yes.
Addictability, how susceptible you are to addictive behaviors is a function of stresses in your life. That fucking makes perfect sense.
Yeah. So, of course, the rats that were removed after 54 days of being addicted to the water in the empty cage.
Yep.
They seemed to have a few twitches of withdrawal, but soon stopped their heavy use and went back to having a normal life. The good cage saved them.
Very interesting.
So this is obviously a pretty radical assault on what we've been told, which is, you know, the chemical gets you hooked and then you have no choice and da-da-da-da-da. So it's kind of crazy. So if the old theory of addiction is right, if it's the drugs that cause it, they make your body need them, then it's obvious what should happen. Loser people should leave the hospital and try to score smack on the streets to meet their habits when they're hospitalized and put on heroin, diamorphine, all of these things. But that never happens. That doesn't happen.
No, you don't get – when I have a tooth pain, I have a bunch of surgeries in my mouth, they give me codeine, right? I get like hydrocodone. I get powerful drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm knocked the heck out for – you know, it's like a major surgery, right?
Yeah.
And I don't – go scoring friggin' oxy and shit afterwards.
No, it virtually never happens. It's Canadian doctor Gabor Maté was the first to explain. Medical users just stopped despite months of use. The same drug used for the same length of time turns street users into desperate addicts and leaves medical patients unaffected.
Why is that? Environment, man.
So, it's pretty interesting. It's just talking about the opposite of addiction is not sobriety. It's human connection.
Very interesting.
So, and that by elevating one's lifestyle, I'm not talking about material things necessarily,
but I do.
That does come into if you have a nice dwelling to live in and you have food on a regular basis and you have a job that feeds you and you are feeling fulfilled in your life, that guess what? You're not going to need to use drugs. It's an escapism. And it's being treated as a chemical issue.
Right. I'm trying to look up. There's a Ibo... I'm going to kill it. Ibogaine, Ibogaine.
Okay.
It's a powerful, powerful hallucinogenic found in the Amazonian rainforest.
Right.
And it's usually and formally like peyote associated with, you know, sort of indigenous people's ceremonial things. And there's been last maybe like 10 years, individuals going to South America and visiting shamans and going on an Ibogaine hallucinogenic journey. And then from that, recovering or stopping their, you know, usually heroin addiction.
Oh, I see. It jump started them to not.
You know, I don't know. There's something, it made me think about that.
Maybe that's what it did.
Maybe that's what it did.
It put them in a state of mind that they were happier.
Absolutely.
And so they were able to kick the habit.
In fact, I don't know how much you know about ecstasy and MDMA, but when it was legal in the 80s and
oh, right, 70s, they used to use it for like therapy, right?
Yeah, yeah, I do remember PTSD that.
PTSD therapy. Like Texas and stuff.
Under, you know, strict, you know, control.
Yeah,
of
like
a,
the
of
doctor would be there.
Yeah.
Right, right.
But, you know, I could imagine a substance like MDMA having a profound impact on, say, you know, couples therapy or some other sort of, you know, allowing you to connect in a way that maybe you wouldn't otherwise, and having some impact in a positive way. And I could see an ibogaine, like I said, almost. And I think before you read this research to me, people that talked about using ibogaine in this manner would describe it as, you know, like a kickstart to your, you know, the way you felt before, and it's sort of like a reset, like a mental cleanse, right? And it just, you come out of it and it's like, okay, I'm not going to go back to using.
Well, I think that if you think about it in a different way, a couple of other things that were brought to light from this. One was, if you think about other addictions that do not have a chemical component but are equally addicting, like shopping or gambling, for example. So obviously you're not injecting, you know, dice into your veins when you are gambling addict, but you're equally as addicted and you can't stop yourself. And it's because you're unhappy with your life that leads you to use this as an outlet to make yourself happy. And then you become addicted to that feeling that you get from gambling. And shopping is frequently the same thing. You shop to make yourself feel better because you're not feeling good. So if you know that we have addictions that exist and are not just recognized, but like recognized in employment law, like you can, you have a gambling addiction, like they have to send you to rehab and stuff.
Yeah, you get,
okay, so
if it's widely
recognized that there are addictions that exist that have no chemical component, why would this not have been applied to addictions that have a chemical component?
Yeah, it's interesting. And it's funny, I remember the disease model of addiction, which is sort of the AA model, frequently like you're damaged goods. It's not you. And, you know, there's a higher power and, you know, you don't have the will, so forth and so on. There has been a lot of, over the years, historical individuals that don't like that approach for this very reason.
Right.
That it kind of focuses on, it imagine, if you will, that the focus on the disease model has prevented us from seeing that the environment has really played a huge role in the addiction of these individuals.
And you never treat the source of the addiction.
You never bother.
You never even discuss it.
You just decide, okay, it's a disease.
I don't have any control, and there's nothing I can do about it except for just take it day by day.
Well, an environment's really a big factor.
Huge. So the other thing that I thought was another piece of information that goes very strongly to me to speaking that they're onto something here is cigarette addiction. So everyone agrees cigarette smoking is one of the most addictive processes around. That's like, you know, everybody knows that.
Yeah.
So the chemical hooks in tobacco come from nicotine, obviously. So when nicotine patches were created in the 1990s, everybody was like, awesome. Everyone's going to get off of cigarettes now because it's a chemical and you can
chew gum and not smoke.
Chew gum and not smoke and be freed. But the Office of the Surgeon General found that just 17.7% of cigarette smokers are able to stop using nicotine patches. That's not nothing. I'm not like, you know, downgrading that. That's pretty significant. But if the chemicals drive 17.7% of the addiction,
what's the other 80?
What about the rest of it?
Yeah.
So I think that this is definitely something to think about. I want to get this book that talks more about this, but I just found it really interesting. And
I agree.
There are definitely a lot of countries worldwide that have applied this thing. Portugal is a really great example. 15 years ago, it had one of the worst drug problems in Europe. 1% of the population was addicted to heroin. Just imagine that, an actual percentage. They had tried a drug war and it just kept getting worse and worse. So they decided to do something completely different. They resolved to decriminalize all drugs and transfer all money that used to be spent on arresting and jailing drug addicts and spent it instead on reconnecting them to their own feelings and to the wider society. The most crucial step was to secure them housing and subsidized jobs so they had a purpose in life and something to get out of bed for. And as they're helped in warm and welcoming clinics to learn how to reconnect with their feelings after years of trauma and stunning them into silence with drugs. And it worked.
Yeah.
It worked.
Fascinating.
So,
really.
It's pretty interesting.
And my family's got a rich history of addiction, right? Going back a long way. Interesting. Very, very interesting.
So I thought it was really interesting and yeah, www.chasingthescream.com.
Chasing the Scream. Website.
You can get the full journey of Jahan Hari's journey through, told through the stories of the people he met. And it's pretty interesting.
Very nice.
So I think that's it for this episode.
Yeah.
I know you're going to go.
Got church business.
Yeah, you got some church business. You're going to go make some money for the church tonight. So yeah. That's good.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Well, so we can get to everything. I know we'll have more.
No,
we'll
definitely talk more. But it was good to. I think we got some good stuff in here.
Yeah, always a fun, awesome. Always a good job. Yeah. And it is the evening, so I'll let Zizi say good night.
Good night, everybody.
High five.